It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, a guest says we put too many people in prison here in the United States. He lays out his 10-step plan to end mass incarceration.
First, there's big news from around the nation's capital this week with a standoff in Congress over Homeland Security funding and the president's veto yesterday of the Keystone XL pipeline bill. You can join in now with your thoughts and questions on those issues at 800-642-1234.
Paul Singer joins us now for his weekly look at the latest from Congress. He's a Washington correspondent for USA Today. Paul, welcome back.
Hey, how you doing, Rob?
I'm good. Well, let's start with the president's first and probably not last veto. It was a bill that would have approved the Keystone XL pipeline. What did the president say? Why did the White House say this veto happened?
Well, you know, he said all along that there is a process in place, an administrative process in place, for reviewing this permit for this pipeline. He believes that process should be respected. And he put out a statement saying, basically, I told you I was going to veto this thing. I still believe the process should be respected. We are reviewing these permits, and we'll make a decision when it's right. And we don't want to create a bad precedent here where basically Congress can just approve whatever project it wants.
And this means that the Keystone pipeline is not necessarily dead. There's still this process going on that could ultimately approve the thing.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, this thing has been in some sort of administrative review since, I think, 2008. I mean, it's still a very live project. I mean, there's a whole bunch of issues about exactly where it goes, whether it goes to sensitive lands, whether there's, you know, enough environmental protection, whatever else. No, I don't think this thing is dead at all. I would not be surprised if ultimately the administration approves it. They just would like to do it on their own terms.
Right. So for the time being, though, what Congress wanted has been vetoed. What's been the response from congressional Republican leaders on this?
Well, of course, a stream of invective saying that basically they think it's a bad idea, that the Obama administration is, you know, they see this, the Republicans see this as a jobs bill, is that if you pass this bill, if you approve this pipeline, it creates, I think they say, like 42,000 construction jobs, and it they say boosts the long-term economy of the nation by providing, you know, more oil opportunities, more oil for domestic refineries, stuff like that. So all kinds of jobs, they think. The Democrats argue that they're, all the jobs are short-term, and once the thing is built, it'll have almost no long-term jobs. So, you know, what the Republicans are saying is Obama has made a mistake. He doesn't care about jobs. He doesn't care about the economy. They would like to override his veto, but they don't have the votes to do it. So I don't know. I don't yet know whether they schedule a vote to try, just to make the point, but I sort of assume they will.
Now, I've heard from various people over the months and years on this that Keystone isn't necessarily the biggest environmental issue, the biggest jobs issue facing the nation, but this thing, it seems like, has become a symbol, an icon of the whole jobs versus environment concept.
Right, because it's a pipeline. You can see it. I mean, it's the nice thing about things like this is that it is a thing. It's an object. We're not talking about sort of is there so many particles per, you know, metric kilogram of air coming out of a smokestack, which is sort of a theoretical construct. It's hard to get your head around. Pipelines, you know, the environmentalists see them as big bad infrastructure, and industry groups see them as big good infrastructure. It's easy to see, put your teeth into, and argue over.
Would Congress have any shot of overriding this veto if they put their minds to it?
Not this Congress. I mean, for a whole bunch of reasons. I mean, you'd have to come up with 67 votes in the Senate. The Republicans only hold, 54 seats. That you'd have to get a lot of Democrats on board to override the veto, and I just don't see why they would do that, why they would buck their own party, buck their own president, and buck the environmental movement and the climate change people who think this is a problem. So I don't see how they do it, but, you know, who knows?
Now, President Barack Obama's veto tally stands right now at 1. That number's going to go up soon, isn't it?
Wait, well, one would suspect it probably will, yeah. You know, again, some of it depends on at what point Republicans get tired of offering bills that they know he's going to veto, and at what point either he or the Republicans decide it's time to start negotiating some deals. You know, we'll see. I think this Homeland Security battle that's going on now offers sort of an interesting insight to see what happens here, because there appear to be some ways around this mess that will not get to a veto, but there are also plenty of opportunities rising for another kind of veto bait bill.
Well, let's get into that Homeland Security funding bill. That's the other big show in D.C. right now. What's the current state of play on that one?
Man, I wish I knew. I mean, really, it's become, we're all sort of scratching our heads. So, as I'm sure your listeners are aware, over the past several weeks, the House passed a funding bill for the Department of Homeland Security, which runs out of money in February, at the end of the month. The House passed a funding bill, but they attached a couple provisions that would prohibit the administration from implementing its executive orders on immigration. You remember that Obama is trying to allow more people to stay legally. If you came here as a child or if you have a child who's a citizen, you'd be able to stay for a while and get a work permit. Anyway, so Obama's trying to do that through executive action. Well, the House passes this bill and says, with provisions saying that that executive action shall be barred. Well, the Senate couldn't get a vote on it. The Democrats kept blocking, kept filibustering, and the Republicans couldn't overcome the filibuster. They tried four times. So yesterday, Mitch McConnell, the Senate leader, said, okay, heck with it. We'll split it into two pieces. We'll vote on the funding, and then we'll vote on a separate bill to block Obama's immigration order. So, all right, well, that would seem to create an opportunity to pass the funding, avert the fear of a shutdown at Homeland Security, and still require Democrats to go on the record, either for or against Obama's immigration executive orders. Problem is, John Boehner, the Speaker of the House, also a Republican, said today, he's not committed to that strategy, and he's not going to say anything about what he's going to do until he sees what the Senate does. So now we don't know. I mean, he also said that he hasn't spoken to Mitch McConnell about it. So we don't really know. We don't know that Republicans have a unified strategy. We don't know what's going to happen next.
And Senate Democrats, I've been seeing, say, we're not going to give the go-ahead on this vote, this clean funding bill that Mitch McConnell wants, until we get an indication from John Boehner that he's going to do the same thing in the House. That sounds like an impasse.
Yeah, well, that has changed in the past half hour or so. The Democrats came out of a caucus meeting and they said, okay, well, we'll go ahead and do the clean bill. I think because they figure they don't have much to lose with a clean bill, because anything the House is going to try and do, if they change it, they would have to go back to the Senate again anyway. They get another chance to vote on it. So, but I think they also are in this position of, and I mean this in the nicest possible way, they're kind of enjoying this little dust-up between McConnell and Boehner, and they're figuring, well, heck, let's play along and see if we can put this back in Boehner's lap.
We're talking to Paul Singer from USA Today, looking at the latest news from Congress, including the vetoed Keystone XL pipeline, a standoff over Homeland Security funding, and coming up, possible Senate candidates for 2016, including, maybe, Russ Feingold.
You can join in with your thoughts. Should Congress try to override the veto of the Keystone XL pipeline? Should the president back down on his immigration plans, given the opposition from Congress and a setback in the courts? Would you like to see Russ Feingold make another Senate run here in Wisconsin? You can call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Paul Singer stays with us now. He's a Washington correspondent for USA Today, and he's bringing us up to date on the latest from Congress, including the Keystone XL pipeline veto, Homeland Security funding, and more.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have a question for Paul about how these things work, this standoff over Homeland Security funding, what happens next for Keystone? 800-642-1234, or an issue we're about to get into. What would you think about a Russ Feingold run for the Senate, maybe a rematch with Ron Johnson in 2016? Call 800-642-1234. Paul, just to wrap up the Homeland Security thing, I mean, they've got till Friday to get this done, right? Are they going to get it done? Is there going to be a shutdown, do you think?
I honestly don't know. One of the rumors we've heard today is that they might try and pass a 3 or 4 day funding extension just to keep the Department of Homeland Security open and running while they argue this out. That is one possible sort of band-aid solution. It is also possible that they force a shutdown. There is some belief that House Republicans particularly want to force a shutdown so that they can prove, A, that a shutdown doesn't really have that much impact, and B, that they were willing to go to the mat over this immigration policy of the administration. So I think sooner or later, folks recognize that they're going to have to fund the agency, but there's also an argument that in the House, they may not be able to get the votes until there's a shutdown and people begin to complain loudly enough to get the conservatives to vote for it.
Well, moving on, there's been a lot of talk about the 2016 presidential elections, but let's look at the race for the Senate. There's been buzz here in Wisconsin about Russ Feingold, as I mentioned, running again in a rematch. And I want to start off with Gary in La Crosse on that topic. Gary, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
Good. What do you think about that idea?
I think it'd be a wonderful idea. I think we need to get Russ Feingold back in the run for Senate against Senator Johnson. I think it'd be great for the state of Wisconsin to have him back in Wisconsin doing great things in the Senate.
Gary,
Wisconsin again.
Gary, thanks a lot for the call. So, Paul, we've been a lot of people in the media have been looking for signs and portents from Russ Feingold. He seems to be hinting from D.C. What's it looking like, the possibility that he might run?
Yeah, well, several months ago, you know, we were working on stories about sort of what the 2016 landscape is going to look like for Democrats. And the theory was that the Democrats had some nice opportunities to pick up some seats because they thought they'd had some endangered Republicans. And Ron Johnson was on that list if Feingold got back in the race. Feingold was sort of the key to making this a competitive seat. He obviously is well known in the state. In 2016, keep in mind, it's going to be a very competitive state. If you have a Hillary Clinton candidacy for president, that's going to bring a lot of very enthusiastic Democrats to the polls. And Wisconsin is a place that can make a really big difference. And it will be harder for Ron Johnson to hold that seat in a kind of Democratic, energized Democratic presidential year against a well-known, well-funded candidate, right, like Russ Feingold.
So what kind of moves are you seeing from Feingold that would suggest that he might be thinking about running?
Well, none really yet, except for the fact that he stepped down from his post in the State Department, which I gather was sort of anticipated and planned. But, you know, he has been talking to some folks, saying that he's seriously considering it. I think at the top of your show, you mentioned his quote from the other day where he said, you know, my once and current and hopefully future chief of staff. You know, he's making the right noises. He's still sitting on leftover campaign money from last time around. I think he's got like $600,000 in the bank, which is not enough for a Senate race, but it's not nothing. So, you know, he is a very realistic possibility, and the Democrats would be thrilled to have him. Needless to say, you know, Ron Johnson is the chairman of the Homeland Security Committee in the Senate. Democrats are taking their every opportunity to blame him if they can for the Homeland Security shutdown threat, so that they can soften up the ground for someone like Russ Feingold to run against him.
And we're seeing some Republican emails going to members of the media saying they'd welcome Russ Feingold. They think he's an easy target. There are a lot of problems that they could focus on. So they're already thinking about a Russ Feingold candidacy, too, it looks like.
Oh, sure. I mean, if you've got a big name like this, they've obviously got awful lot of opposition research they've done on him over the years. He's been, you know, he ran for re-election there three times, so he's well known. There's plenty, I'm sure, to dig up from his Senate record. They will try to paint him as too liberal for the state and out of touch with the regular Wisconsinites, and he's been, you know, in Washington, out of the state for a while. So he's spending all his time in Africa. So maybe, I mean, there's no doubt it'll be a tough fight, but I think the Democrats see him as their best opportunity.
Democrats tend to do better in Wisconsin. We've had a pattern for a while now. In presidential election years and in midterm elections, they do really staggeringly poorly the last couple times around. Is that common in other states, or is this some unique Wisconsin thing?
No, it's common in a lot of states. The Democratic voter base doesn't really turn out in midterm elections. with nearly the kind of results they get during a presidential election. That was particularly the case with Barack Obama. He was a very mobilizing candidate for a lot of the Democratic base, for minorities particularly, for young people particularly. He drove enormous flocks of Democrats to the polls. There is a really good chance that Hillary Clinton could do the same, again, particularly for women and young people, possibly as well for minorities. That's sort of a standard theme in a lot of these so-called swing states. In the off years, Republicans have a better shot. In the on years, Democrats have a better shot.
Are Democrats looking at picking up Senate seats in 2016? Do they have a good shot based on what is or who's up for re-election?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. In 2014, sorry, my years get confused in my head. In 2014, most of the seats that were up were Democratic seats. The Democrats were defending most of the seats that were up. I believe this time around in 2016, there's something like 24 Republican seats that'll be up for re-election, and Democrats feel like they have a good shot at probably half dozen of those. The Senate will be in play, or at least the Democrats believe the Senate will be in play if they can get good candidates and, if the economy continues to improve. That's really the key here. If the economy continues to improve under Obama's watch, it takes away one of the Republicans' greatest arguments for Republican Senate.
We'll leave it there for now. Paul, as always, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Rob. Got to get me one of those magnets.
All right. Good luck. They're going fast, man, so do it quick. That's Paul Singer, Washington correspondent for USA Today. He joins us each week at this time for the latest from Congress. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up later, we'll get the latest news on a proposed right-to-work bill here in Wisconsin.
First, a new report shows that the U.S. imprisons 7 to 10 times more of its citizens than any other developed Western countries. Many states put more money into prisons than higher education.
Our guest says he has a solution to that problem, a 10-step blueprint to end mass incarceration. Michael Tonry joins us to tell us about his plan. He's a law professor at the University of Minnesota. His books include Thinking About Crime and Crime and Justice in America. Michael, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Can you give us a sense of the scope of the problem that you see in mass incarceration in America?
Sure. It's not just a problem as I see it. It's now a left and white agreed problem of many people in prison for much too long that costs a great deal. As you probably know, and as many of your readers may have heard, there's now a conservative-liberal consensus on this. Figures as prominent as Newt Gingrich are insisting that what we do in prisons is a tragedy and ruins hundreds of thousands of lives unnecessarily, and there seems to be agreement that we need to do something about it.
The story of how we got here is a long one, but in short, how do you think we ended up where we are today?
Well, there are two answers. One answer is, the small answer is that crime rose in the United States in the 1970s and 80s, peaked in 1991, and has been falling ever since. But during that time, just about everybody became a little bit more or a lot more intolerant of crime and criminals, and so judges became tougher, prosecutors became tougher, parole boards became tougher, and so the prison population increased. That's the small part. The big part was that in the 1980s, all across the U.S., there were laws enacted that required prison sentences of lengths that were simply unprecedented in American history and are unprecedented in any other country in the developed world. I mean, for example, all 50 states have something called life without the possibility of parole laws that now hold 60,000 people in American prisons. In the rest of the developed world, such laws do not exist. In the European Union, which under the European Convention on Human Rights, to which 70 countries are signatories, it's simply unconstitutional. In most countries, the longest sentence that can be imposed on anybody for anything is 12 or 15 or 20 years. But we got into a pattern of enacting laws that required people to spend decades or lifetimes in prison. And over the years, they've just accumulated. I mean, the starkest example I know is that half the states have laws that are called three strikes and you're out laws, on the baseball metaphor.
Right, these are some of the tough-on-crime laws that you'd like to see rolled back.
Yes, and Under these three strike laws enacted in 26 states between 94 and 96, requiring minimum 25-year prison sentences, not one person has ever yet been released from prison who has been sentenced under one of those laws. And so if each year another 10 or 20 or 30 or 50,000 go in, nobody comes out. They just accumulate. And that's the major driver for why we have so many people in prison.
Right, and you mentioned three strikes laws and also mandatory minimum sentences. These are under the umbrella of tough on crime laws. Why do you think we should do away with them?
Well, we should do. There are three reasons. One, the strongest one is simply that they are breathtakingly cruel and have extraordinary negative effects on not only on prisoners but on prisoners' families and on the communities that they come from. That's the primary reason. The second reason, politicians would say my second reason is their first. It just costs enormous amounts of money. It costs, depending on the state, anywhere from $50,000 to $125,000 a year to hold one person in prison. We hold six times more people in prison relative to our population than we did 25-30 years ago, which means we are paying six times more to lock people up than we ever did before. When you remember that in most Western countries, the imprisonment rate is about 100 per 100,000 population. Ours is over 700. So we're seven times over our own historical norm, because we were in the mainstream of Western countries 30 years ago. And we remain way out of line with anybody else in the world. So it's very, very expensive, is a second reason.
Don't we need to make sure that we've got the rehabilitation end of things squared away before we do things like repeal some of those tough-on-crime laws?
Well, the answer is no. You know, we know a huge amount about the life courses of people who become involved in crime. There's a process that the technical term is desistance. It's a simple idea. Most people who commit offenses stop doing it. Most do it pretty young. There's a kind of research which is described with the term age and crime curves, which tells us that very large percentages of people do things when they are young that could get them into serious trouble, things that are crimes. But the peak age for property crime is 15, and the peak age for violent crime is 17. People desist after that. They get older. They get a stake in conformity. They find the man or woman they love. They find God. They get a job. They have stakes in society that make it stupid to do things that are going to ruin their lives, and people stop. So by the time you get to age 30, almost nobody continues offending. So holding people in prison who are 35 or 40 or 45 or 50 or 55 or 60 has almost nothing to do with public safety. So for those people, we don't need new recidivism reduction programs. We just need to figure out ways to get them out of prison. For younger people, many will stop offending on their own. But for those who don't, there is now a plethora of newly developed, newly evaluated programs that show that for almost every kind of offender, well-designed programs that are well-implemented and adequately funding can significantly reduce reoffending. So we have the technology now, but we don't need it for many of these people who are just sitting warehoused in prisons for very long times.
Well, you mentioned the age factor, and you think that age should play a factor in that prison time and that people over the age of 35 should term shorter prison terms.
That's true.
How come?
Depends. I mean, there are two problems tied up. We got into a pattern in the United States in the 1980s and 90s of stopping thinking about the effects of prison sentences on the people who serve them. And so the idea of imposing 20, 30, 40, 50 life without parole sentences just came into vogue for those people. So we have sentences that are just very, very, very long, and no particularly important public purpose is served by holding these people, but we spend an awful lot of money doing it.
Now, along with changing laws, you'd like to see prisons reduce their rates of confinement to half of 2014 levels by the year 2020. That's fairly ambitious. Is that kind of timeline realistic, given all the pieces that have to come into play to make that happen?
Well, we have to have. Of course, in one sense, it's not realistic, and it's not going to happen. In another sense, reducing our imprisonment rate to what it was in 1980 is still 350 per 100,000, which is four times just about that of the average Western country. And we have to have some kind of a goal. All over the United States, state legislatures are enacting laws that are slightly pulling back on the excesses of the 1980s. But they're doing it in very small ways that might be described as nibbling at the edges of the problem. So, for example, laws that require minimum 10 or minimum 20-year sentences for street-level drug sellers. Those laws don't do anything at all. This is well known among cops as well as it is among academics. Those laws don't do anything at all to reduce drug trafficking or drug sales or drug use. They send a lot of people to prison. The kinds of changes that are being made now are changes that create small exceptions for first-time drug offenders with no prior record, may become eligible for release from prison after 5 years rather than 10 or 20. That's fine. It's important for them, for those individual human beings and their lives, but it isn't going to reduce the prison population very much. What will reduce it is repealing laws that require that 17-year-olds go to prison for 10 or 20 years for selling drugs on the street corner.
Michael, we leave it there. Thank you so much for joining us.
Pleasure. Bye-bye.
We've been speaking with Michael Tonry, professor of law at the University of Minnesota. His 10-step plan to end mass incarceration in America is linked on the Central Time Facebook page.